You're listening to Conversations with Musicians with Leah Roseman. Josh so-called Dolgan is an amazing creative force, and this interview really had to be a longer one because he does so much and there was so much I wanted to ask him about. We started with his remix of Curried Soul for CBC Radio's Daily Show As It Happens and circle around to topics including sampling, hip-hop, Yiddish culture, changes in the industry from when he got a start selling CDs, mail order from his apartment to touring internationally and collaborating with many musicians, some of whom we discussed, including the funk legend Fred Wesley, David Krakauer, Kieran Ahluwalia, Yitzhak Perlman, Theodore Bikel, about writing musical theater, his puppets, his art. Here's a chance for all of us to get to know the creative force known as Josh so-called Dolgan. Hi, Josh so-called Dolgan.
Hello.
Thank you so much for joining me. So I, boy, you're one of these people, like I'm going to try to describe you to people who don't know who you are. Let's see. Pianist, accordionist, rapper, producer, filmmaker, puppet maker, magician, singer, composer. I would say like artistic magnet, like you bring all these people and genres together. What have I missed there?
I mean, it's a funny question these days because like it's been 2 years of basically being sitting in this room. So, so I forget what I did or what I am or what I was supposed to be doing or something, but that was a very good start. I have a lot of hobbies and a lot of interests and passions. And yes, I do like to bring people together and sort of bring the different passions together.
Yeah. So let's start with Curried Soul Remix.
Oh.
So any Canadians listening will probably be very familiar with the As It Happens theme, originally Mo Kaufman, 1969, if I'm right. Mm-hmm. And you were commissioned to remix this.
Yes. Well, actually, it started out off as a competition.
Okay.
Where they asked a bunch of producers to take this like hallowed piece of Canadian culture, because really, like, why mess with it? It's like this perfect, it's a beautiful song, but it's also just the perfect package with that show As It Happens and that sound. And it's just like, I grew up with it, like all Canadians, like every single day hearing that awesome tune. And so the CBC has a way of trying to sort of, you know, be hip and try to stay relevant or something. And so they think, hey, let's mess with that. Let's spruce it up. So they asked a bunch of producers to like deal with the material and see if they could come up with something. And they only really gave us like the track. There was no multi-track recording or like whatever. We just got the raw track. I think it was even just an MP3. I'm not even sure it was a WAV file. And so they gave it to a bunch of producers and they said, do something. So I went to, actually, it's a studio in Ottawa that I do all my work out of. Well, I used to before the end of the world. This family of producers with the name of Bova. And there's Phil Senior, and then there's Phil Junior. And I started working with Phil Senior, and then I continued to work with both of them. And so I went to Phil Junior's studio, and we started messing around with the track. And I came up with a thing, and CBC loved it. So they asked me to actually finish what I'd started. Mm-hmm. And so that's been on the radio for about 9 years now, actually. Three times a day, you hear my version of the Mo Kaufman Curried Soul as the theme song, which is an honor and super cool. And I love hearing it when I turn on the radio, but I'm also mad because between you and me and your listeners, the only reason that the Kaufman estate agreed to it would be to retain all the publishing. So I got paid a little bit to do the work, and I never saw another penny, and it's been heard, I don't know, millions of times.
Yeah.
And what people hear isn't Mo Kaufman anymore. it's a lot of my work, and it's actually me playing flute on the keyboard, and it's like I replayed everything and the beats are all new and stuff. So it's kind of a little weird that that me as the living musician whose work is heard every single day on the CBC across the country, I don't get anything from it other than the great satisfaction of knowing that that I did something cool.
Yeah. So yeah, this kind of brings to like the when you got involved with sampling and stuff. But actually, Mo Kaufman, he was a cool guy. Like, I was looking him up because this was the theme I'd heard, and I never really thought, like, who was this guy? What was his background?
Right. Quite super cool. I actually have a somewhere in this room. I'm in my childhood bedroom, by the way, where I've been for two and a half years. And somewhere in it is a signed ticket of Mo Kaufman that I went to see when I was in high school. Our high school jazz band went to Toronto for some like music competition or something. And we went out to see Mo Kaufman play at a bar. And I still have the signed ticket.
Did he
super
do that?
Cool guy.
Did he do that thing where he played two saxophones at once and improvise? Like with the,
it was 30 years ago. I don't remember a darn thing. If I didn't have the signed ticket, I wouldn't remember that we actually went to see that.
Had you known at the time you'd have this connection with him later on, you would have remembered it better, right?
Sure. There you go.
So sampling. I imagine now there's copyright issues that didn't exist when this started.
Huh. I mean, there's been a sort of learning curve of how to deal with the intellectual property, that the sort of issues that arise with sampling. But I think probably by now they've got it worked out pretty well. It was kind of in the early 90s when it became like the most used method of making hip hop, by taking these old records and taking old sounds and chopping them up. The lawyers went crazy and started to really sort of dictate how that would work. And there was a lot of famous sort of lawsuits at that time of people that had before, when it was kind of a Wild West where you really could just do whatever and there was no repercussions, you just took stuff. Well, that got tied down pretty quick. And I've always kind of avoided the whole issue just by virtue of the sounds that I sample, which are usually less well known. I mean, the trick with sampling is that it's all fair game if you don't get caught. if you can change a sound enough, if you can slow it down or chop it into different pieces and flip it upside down, then you're not sampling something that's easily identified, and then you're good to go. And for me, that was always sort of the trick. That was like that was the challenge, was to not just take a catchy, fat, amazing sample and then loop it and then have a song. I mean, where's the skill in that? Actually, this guy just passed away a couple of days ago, Matume. I don't know if you heard about him, but his song Juicy Fruit was sampled by the Notorious B.I.G. and by Puff Daddy. And it's one of Biggie's biggest, most famous songs. And it's really just Juicy Fruit, just literally Juicy Fruit. Maybe they changed a little bit here and there, but they took that whole song. They thought, wow, that's awesome. Rap on that. And that was never really that wasn't what was fun for me. What I wanted to do was take things that didn't sound super cool right off the bat and see if I could repurpose them, chop them up so that they're unrecognizable, or also just sampling weird things that nobody would have ever heard, often things even just before copyright, things from the 1920s and things from the whatever.
So you got into Yiddish because of sampling, I understand.
In a roundabout way, that's kind of a nice way of putting it, is that I got into making hip hop and sampling and collecting old records and looking for, looking for sounds that were a little bit off the beaten track. And also for sounds that represented my history and where I came from a little bit. I felt weird sampling Black music and taking from African-American culture. I was going to participate in hip hop, which is already African-American and Black culture. So to find a voice within that and to find sort of something that felt real for me meant looking for sounds that reflected my identity. And I don't know if it was, I don't know if I started off quite that like didactically, like I've got to do this. Like, I think that sort of just started coming to me in during the process of becoming a hip hop producer. And also just looking at hip hop, which is about representing where you're from and who you are and being real. You got to keep it real. And you talk about your crew, you talk about where you're from, you talk about your little corner of the city. And so who am I, this white Jewish kid in Canada? I mean, I love funk. And in fact, funk is what got me to hip hop. So I already loved the source of hip hop. And then, but it just felt weird for me to sample James Brown and the Meters and Sly and the Family Stone and to do this sort of other layer of cultural colonialism that it was the 90s. I didn't even know about that idea of cultural colonialism or of cultural appropriation, really. It was sort of before all that discourse started. But maybe it was starting then. And I didn't want to be a part of that. So I started to look for sounds that could be my story, that could tell my story in this new style of music. And so that's when I started to really fall upon Jewish music. And the Jewish music, this was because I moved to Montreal. I started to find that kind of music in the Salvation Armies there, people that were getting rid of their record collections. And so I started to find Jewish music. And I keep doing this for Jewish music because it's kind of an absurd idea, Jewish music. What is Jewish music? Is it a Jewish composer? Anything they write is Jewish music? Maybe not. Is it something in a certain language? Is it a style? Well, it's complicated. Jews lived all over the world. They were influenced by the music of wherever they were. They influenced the music of wherever they were. They spoke in many different languages. Jews are, of course, many different races. They were in North Africa. There's Arab Jews and there's Jews that speak Spanish and Portuguese and Chinese Jews, whatever. So what is Jewish music? And so that sort of began an exploration for me. My roots are Eastern European Jewish. So that's Romania, Ukraine, Russia. And so I started to get interested in that and in the language of Yiddish, and I started to find Yiddish theater records. I started to find instrumental Jewish dance music, which we all know now as klezmer. I started to find cantorial music, music from the synagogue. And I started to find Hasidic music, the music of the religious 19th century Jews. And their whole tradition of nigunim, which are these wordless melodies that are incredible. So I started to find those and started to find on those records stuff that I could sample without like all that identity politics, like aside, these records were full of catchy, funky, like loopable, cool sounds that also, as a bonus, were a little bit off the beaten track and like not something I was going to get sued for, and a new sound that reflected who I was, that still could fit in this new hip hop paradigm.
So in 2005, you produced, I think, in your own apartment in Montreal and sold through mail order your album. What was it called? So-called Seder?
Yeah. So, I mean, that was the beginning of a world where you could do things like that. Like, I was sort of blessed and cursed to have started in this music business at the time, there was a golden age of CDs, of selling CDs. CDs cost nothing to make. It's like it costs a penny. It's a piece of plastic, but you could sell them for $25 each. So the music industry made a killing. Records cost a bit more physically to produce them. So this was just like unbelievable. And it was before the internet. It was before everything was just free and floating through the air. So there was just this golden window of people selling music like mad. And so I saw a bit of that. And I sort of started working as a professional musician in that sort of environment where it was like, oh, you could make a record and then you could sell it. And then you could make back the money that it costs to make the record. And then you could make a living as a musician. Wow, what a concept.
Yeah.
And so I was part of that. And like, I got a record deal and like it was touring and it was on the radio and stuff like that. And then I saw the end of that. I saw the beginning of the internet. But what comes with that sort of dark side of the story is also this incredible like potential that came with these new technologies of someone like me in my basement, able to make a record. Which just hadn't really existed before. Like if you had a four track, you could make something, but you'd sort of need to go to a studio and fix it up. And then to reproduce it, you'd have to, you know, get a record deal or do something. But for a guy like me to just be all by myself, make a sound, create a thing, and then make a package for it, da 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 da, and then physically produce it myself. Like that was kind of a brave new world. And that then led to me getting, you know, proper record contracts and making real records in studios and stuff. But that first record, was an adventure.
So here we are talking in January, 2022, and in 2021, you produced so-called instrumentals, right?
Yes.
So it's sort of like full circle to me, like you're on your own.
Yeah, it's trippy. I mean, that record is kind of a compilation of things that I've done. Mm-hmm. But you're right, I did in the past couple years in this pandemic I was forced again to make things here. And I don't like it. I miss the studio and I miss collaboration and I miss the layers of production that I'd sort of built, like the way that you make a song. Okay, you get an arrangement from somebody, maybe we'll write an arrangement. Okay, then you go and record drums over here, and then maybe you fly to LA and get a singer to record on it, and then you, mm-hmm. like there's just so many fun, and then you work with an amazing mixing engineer, and then you work with an orchestra, and then you work, like there was just so many fun connections that mm-hmm. now are all just happening over Zoom calls and it's a strange time to say the least.
But before this latest Omicron thing, which will be history soon, I got to hear you live.
Amen to that.
Yeah, in Die Frosch, your wonderful Yiddish songs show here at the National Arts Center. And boy, are you amazing live. I mean, I love your recordings, but you're such a great performer.
Well, cool. Thanks for coming. I appreciate it. And in fact, that project is a full circle coming mm-hmm. Because it's me just singing with a string quartet. And I never was a singer. Like when I started off in the music thing, like I played piano and sure, I was in some musicals a bit in Ottawa growing up as a teenager. And I guess I have a good ear and I don't know how I learned to sing, but I just, when I started to hear those old records of Yiddish songs, for some reason, that's what made me want to sing. Mm-hmm. I wanted to sing those songs. And at first I was sampling these old records, using it to make hip hop and make new funky, crazy Jewish music. Okay, that's cool. But then now here I am just singing songs with a string quartet. So I never saw that one coming. And that's like, that's just a testament to the sort of that's so
amazing about life sometimes is that you don't really know why or what you're doing, or you sort of think you're on a track for some reason, but then you start to, things dribble into the track and then they sort of take you on another track. And then that can become like your most favorite project.
Yeah. And you're obviously a person who just says yes all the time to all kinds of opportunities.
Yeah, maybe a bit. I also say no to some, yeah, to some things.
You have to, I'm sure.
Yeah. And you just have to do things that you can't explain. Like, it just feels good, or you just, mm-hmm, they just touch you magically. For instance, Kurt Vile.
Yeah.
I found a Kurt Vile record when I was 20, digging for records. I found this record of Teresa Stratus singing Kurt Vile. I never heard of Teresa Stratus. I never heard of Kurt Vile. Maybe I'd heard of the Three Penny Opera, but just random. I mean, that digging through records was such an incredible education in music. And especially then, when people were really throwing out their record collections, you when you had to buy a CD for $25, you maybe didn't buy every CD in the store, right? But if a record is 25 cents, you can buy 100 records and just check it out. So this Kurt Vile thing 20 years ago, or maybe more now, like, I just heard this one song of Kurt Vile. Actually, it's called Nana's Lied. Maybe you can like put it in the episode, mm-hmm, or something. You can pop it in there. And it just blew my mind. I never thought in a million years I'd be able to sing that or play it on the piano or something. It was just this incredible composition. But now I'm totally obsessed with Kurt Vile. And I've spent the last 20 years learning Kurt Vile repertoire. Yeah, so that's just another, like, that's just a weird interest that has become an obsession.
Yeah, I have to say, by the way, about the Die Frosch, the Frog show, your string, mm-hmm, quartet arrangements were beautiful.
Awesome.
Yeah, you know, I'm a violinist, and just really your string writing was so nice.
Cool. I didn't do them all by any means. I did a bunch of them, but I got some friends to do it, particularly this guy, Michael Winograd, who's, mm-hmm, an amazing clarinetist, but just a huge musical brain. This friend of mine, Michael Dubay, who's an awesome musician from the Hylotrons from Ottawa, who's got his own amazing recording studio lately. And I took old arrangements like piano. Let me see, do I have something around here? No, I was just gonna look. Oh yeah, maybe I do. Here you go. So I found like can you see that? No.
Yeah,
like either piano charts. Here's one from 1921. Either piano charts, these awesome sheet music from like the 20s and teens. Or choral arrangements. These are some like four part harmony, mm-hmm, but for Yiddish songs. This is from the 60s actually. And so I just, in archives, there's something called the Yiddish Book Center in Amherst, Mass. There's the YIVO in New York City. They have, and just there's tons of music that is just sitting there. Nobody looks at this stuff. Like, sure, there's some nerds, and there's some choir directors, and there's like maybe the odd person who's interested in Yiddish song goes to these places, but mostly not. Most of the people are lazy. If they want anything, they go on the internet and download a lead sheet or a sheet of lyrics. But there's all this incredible repertoire. And at first I was into singing in harmony, mm-hmm, but then I found it was hard to get a choir together. It was hard to get four voices to learn the parts and stuff. And I thought, what if I just write this stuff out for string quartet, mm-hmm, so that whenever I want, people can play it. It'll be in tune and we'll just hear it. Like, it'll be a way to hear this stuff. So I would take these four part, these like either piano parts or the arrangements, and then like just rearrange them for four voices. Mm-hmm.
So the Yiddish Book Center, have they digitized their music collection along with a lot of their Yiddish books?
That's a very good question. I'm not sure. They, to be honest, their music collection is mostly these like piano charts, mm-hmm, which are interesting and which are actually, they're just beautiful objects. I just love them physically, from 1927. I mean, it's in perfect shape. This thing is 90 years old. But they got a lot of their collection of sheet music from like from out of business sheet music companies. So a lot of what they have is stuff that didn't sell. So their collection is has huge holes in it because it's basically just overstock. So it's like basically a lot of copies of weird songs that nobody wanted to hear. So I'm not so sure it's that useful. I mean, it's useful because even that is a vast collection of stuff that you can explore. But they have all of that and more at other archives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I actually started studying Yiddish because I read Aaron Lansky's book about the, the man who's, what was it called? The Man Who Saved a Million Books.
That's it.
Yeah.
Cool.
And I mean, I heard Yiddish as a kid. My parents spoke it to typical, like, so we wouldn't understand. But they would speak with the older relatives. But I just always kind of resented it because I didn't understand it. But when I read that story, it just blew me away. So I've been dabbling in Yiddish for like 3 years now, which is why I heard about you.
Okay.
Someone said, well, if you're studying Yiddish, there's this guy and he does like, so.
Where are you from?
Ottawa, actually.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah, we didn't have so much Yiddish to experience in Ottawa, did we, growing up here?
Yeah, it was like with, my parents grew up in Montreal. My mom even went to Parrot Shula and like knew how to read and write. And, but I mean, I'm older than you and it was like that generation of the immigrants still being around.
That's it.
So yeah, like when you're transcribing, like you must read Yiddish now.
Yeah.
People may not realize it's written with Hebrew script because it's often written with English, but it's not the original. Yeah, I have that too. Yeah,
keep it around. Yeah. And so, yes, I, like you said, I mean, this is a long story. We could get into it. Just the sort of idea of Yiddish in secular, in secular Canadian culture. These people that have what's the word? I'm losing my word for assimilated.
Yeah.
For assimilated Jews stopped speaking Yiddish, basically. I mean, it's a very long story. But when I grew up in Ottawa, well, in Chelsea, Quebec, which is just north of Ottawa, we'd go into Temple Israel on the Ottawa side, and we'd go to Hebrew school.
That's right.
Okay, there you go. See? Nice. So great. So I learned how to read Hebrew, but not understand it because I just had to do my bar mitzvah. Okay, great. Yeah. So you get this text and you can enunciate it, say it out loud, and you do the bar mitzvah thing. That's cool. But I never was into religion. I just always was fighting against it. And then when I found Yiddish, I found this whole situation that is written in the letters that I knew already. So it was kind of an amazing revelation to be able to now read all this material that actually can sort of make a little bit of sense. I mean, when you're reading Hebrew, it's this ancient weird language, but Yiddish is, as we know, a mixture of Old German with all the Romance languages and this and that. So when you're reading something in Yiddish, like legislature. Okay, that's the legislator. I'm just reading in the dictionary.
Yeah.
So it's amazing access to like a whole thing. So I've learned in the singing of the songs, I'm learning the language. I've never really sat down and tried to really learn the language. I have some misgivings about that. I just feel weird to learn a language that I'll never really talk with anybody except for other nerds that have learned the language. I want to sing the songs. I want to know what I'm singing. I've been doing it for 20 years. So I've certainly got a vocabulary. I can certainly understand what's going on.
Yeah.
But I don't like to say that I really speak and write and read Yiddish. I can read it. I can write it. I don't know.
So for a lot of people listening won't know, and I think it might be interesting to them, that the Hasidim, are not allowed to access all the secular material in Yiddish. And they, you know, religious Jews, I think, also weren't at the beginning of the 20th century going to Yiddish theater or films or reading novels or, you know, all the things that translations of all kinds of literature into Yiddish. So all that was like, they're not allowed.
I don't know about not allowed. It's just that they're not allowed to engage with secular culture in general. It's
right.
So but, whether or not it's in Yiddish, it doesn't matter.
Well, it matters to me because like there's this wealth of Yiddish that they're culture not, that they're yeah. not accessing, and it's their first language. So.
Yeah, but there's a wealth of Yiddish culture that we're not accessing because a wealth of religious Yiddish culture that we're not accessing. They don't mind. They're making their own culture. They have their own music. They have their own literature. Don't worry about it too much. They're okay. They're fine.
You'd mentioned Nigunim before, these wordless songs.
Yeah.
And I was I heard your talk you did for the Yiddish Book Center last year, and you had mentioned that there was notated Nigunim in the archives, which I found quite interesting that someone bothered to write these down. And you also mentioned that klezmer musicians tended not to write down their songs or arrangements because they kind of kept it to themselves and passed it down.
Did I mention that? Okay. I think it was just a question of economics and stuff. Like they just weren't educated necessarily in that way. I think at a certain point, even in Hasidic history, they started to write down just even what the rabbis had said. And that was a big move to do that. And I think it's just at a certain point in a culture, it's just like, okay, like we got to get this down somehow, like before we forget it all. I'd be curious to look into when they did start notating all the Nigunim. It could be a fairly modern idea to write them down. And even post-war, even just like when they realized, oh my God, like we've lost so much, like we better write this down. Mm-hmm. Those books are great. You should get those books. They're called the Sefer HaNigunim, the Nigunim books. And it's a 2-volume set put out by, I think it's Chabad Lubavitch. And you can find it anywhere. But they're awesome. They have, and if you get better at Yiddish, then you can read all the sort of explanations for each niggun, because every niggun has a story. Every niggun was composed by some famous rabbi also the website, there's like Chabad.org. Do you know that website?
I know about it, yeah.
Okay, because it has every volume they made a series of records for Nigunim, for Chabad Nigunim, Lubavitch Nigunim, which is just one sort of dynasty of Hasidim. But they made these records in like the 50s and 60s of groups of Hasidim singing these Nigunim. And all of those records have been digitized and they're all available at that website. It's just very convenient, handy way to see. And it has all the, it's sort of in affiliation with the book. Like you can read along with that book and you can go, okay, page, whatever. And then it actually has the story of the niggun. It has the melody written out. It has the words, if there are words, because not every niggun is just without words. Yeah, that's a great resource.
Cool.
There's lots of resources now. Online.
Yeah. So Tales from Odessa was a Yiddish musical theater piece that you wrote the words and music for, and it was commissioned after somebody saw your incredible puppet musical The Season, right?
Something like that. Yes. Yeah, so the director at Siegel Center, they actually kind of supported this first musical that I wrote, which is called The Season. It's got these fuzzy puppets. I think there's one over there. Yeah, no, you can't really see them. I'll go get them later. So I had all these puppets kicking around. Someone said, we want to do a show with involving different people in the scene. So like a dancer and this, and I was like, okay, I'm going to write a musical. I'll put the puppets. I made a show. It was cool. We were supposed to just do it one night. We did it one night, but like I had all this music and I'd written a musical. So I went into the studio. I recorded it. It's called The Season. Check it out. And then that led to other things. I've gone on to do season 2 and season 3. And hopefully I'll do season four next year in, or this year in Germany, but I don't believe anything is going to happen this year again. So who knows? But yes, so the director of the Siegel Center said, hey, would you be interested in writing something for our Yiddish theater, which, as you know, is the basically one of the, maybe the two operating Yiddish theaters in North America today. Mm-hmm. This used to be, there used to be hundreds of Yiddish theaters in America and in Canada with plays going on all the time. Like, can you imagine the amazing scene of like Second Avenue with literally dozens of theaters open doing new shows all the time? Like, holy cow, what a amazing thing that we missed. So that's sad, but there are still these two Yiddish theaters, this Dora Wasserman Yiddish Theater. So they asked me, what would you do if you were to do a Yiddish theater show? And I thought about it for a while. And then I realized I wanted to do something that should be a story that could be in Yiddish. If you're going to go to the trouble of doing a Yiddish theater show, like, why? And basically no one understands Yiddish except for older people or Hasidim or a couple nerds who are learning Yiddish now. Like, it's going to be in translation. So you're going to have people watching the show in a language they don't understand. actually, this was many layers of translation because I was like, it's got to be something where there's a reason for these people to be living and acting in Yiddish. So I'd sort of been a little bit obsessed with Isaac Babel and his Odessa stories. I don't know if have you ever read them?
I have not.
Get on it. It's awesome. These are these gangster stories, Jewish gangsters in Odessa at the turn of the last century. And this incredible sort of Robin Hood figure of this guy, Benya Crick, who's the king of the Jewish gangsters. And these like violent, funny, sexual, amazing stories that to me were kind of like Fiddler on the Roof upside down. Like Fiddler on the Roof. Okay, we get it. We've seen Fiddler on the Roof. Okay. And that presents a very kind of idyllic, nostalgic, sentimental view of the shtetl of the old Jewish Eastern European world. I mean, it's based on these amazing old Sholem Aleichem Yiddish stories, but then it was converted for Broadway to become this sort of weird, like, simulacra of Jewish existence in Eastern Europe. Great. How about some gritty, like, swearing, violent prostitutes, like, killing, like, Jewish stories? Okay. Well, these Odessa stories are that, and the stories themselves are like, they can't be translated onto the stage. They're so, the language of them, and I'm not reading them in the original Russian, but Isaac Babel is just this incredibly famous writer in Soviet Russia for his language and for his incredible writing. So when you're translating something, or like converting something from the page to the stage, like, you kind of gotta throw your hands up and not, like, it's not the same thing. It's different. So that's fine. So I kind of relaxed into that idea and that notion. And I said, let's do this. They said, cool. And so, yeah, that was an amazing passion project. I got to basically design everything, and I worked with my favorite this amazing costume designer, and we really did like research on like historical dress of Odessa and of Jews in Odessa, and then I put together a band and I wrote music for like a real, like, a village band that might have been in Odessa. So I hired in Montreal I hired a Romanian cymbalom player, a Bulgarian flute, like, nai player, mm-hmm. a Roma, like, Moldovan accordionist, because Montreal has these people living there, you know? So I'd sort of met them in the Jewish music scene, meeting musicians from Eastern Europe. So I got them. I got Michael Winograd, who I spoke about before, mm-hmm. to come up from New York City. He's really one of the great Jewish klezmer clarinetists today. And then like actually Pemi Paul, who was from the quartet that you saw, he was in there too. And a bass player, a drummer. And it was like a real like fake Eastern European band playing new original songs for an old story that was written in Russian that I wrote in English and then was translated into Yiddish. And then you read it with subtitles. It's ridiculous. But what an opportunity, probably once in a lifetime, I have to say, unless they ask me to do it again, but things have changed there a little bit. And also just, it's harder and harder to, I mean, right now, nobody's doing anything.
Yeah.
But also the Yiddish theater scene, it's not quite as strong as, believe it or not, as it was 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. Like, at least there was support then. It's sort of, it's harder and harder to get the audience to come out. So mm-hmm. for me, it was the once in a lifetime opportunity to work with a company, to work with a real theater company. There was 40 people on stage. Like, it was, and to get that kind of support and that kind of space, even just the space, they own their theater. Mm-hmm. So to rehearse, they have a big fat space to work in. That's rare. Mm-hmm. And because the cast is mostly volunteers, amateurs, well, to get 40 people dedicated to a project, that's impossible in theater and in professional worlds. So it was really just just mind-blowing to see to see my work presented like that. I went every single night that it was on. It was on for about 3 weeks, and I went, maybe I missed a couple, but I would just go and sit in the theater and watch the curtains open, and there's Odessa with this band playing these songs. Out of control. And I got to work with Miriam Hoffman, who is an amazing translator and thinker. She's actually, her book is incredible. So she translated with the help of the Dora Wasserman Yiddish Theater. Mm. They translated, because I wrote the lyrics and the text of the play. Actually, I know I worked with a playwright, now that I think about it, this guy, Derek Goldman, he wrote the script. Mm-hmm. But I wrote all the songs in English, and he wrote the script in English based on these Russian stories that were mm-hmm. translated. And then she translated it into Yiddish.
There's short clips on YouTube that look great, but is there like a full-length thing that like you have access to or people can buy?
I have a video tape of not a tape. I mean, I have it on my computer, but I mm-hmm. do have like the camera on a tripod showing yeah. the show. And actually, I have a couple other angles. It's a little clunky to watch it like that. I hate watching my theater shows like that are just filmed. Like they just, it doesn't read. It's like, it's painful to watch, but it's a way to see it for sure. But if you want to hear it, it's out as a record. For
yeah,
sure.
No, I know that. Yeah. No, I was just wondering, it because you're saying so much work, and this is
right.
It would be a shame if it was lost to history.
Puppets too. There was this amazing Clea Miniker is this amazing puppeteer who is a master of shadow puppets, mm-hmm. And so I got her to do. There was a whole layer of like shadow puppetry mm-hmm. going on in the background, like. Well, like all the windows had screens and stuff. So like mm-hmm. different stuff would be happening in the screens.
Wow, that's great.
It should happen again. I mean, I would love to see it happen somewhere. I'd really love to see it in Odessa. And what I'd love to see too is like a filmed version of it. Like mm-hmm. not a filmed stage version of it, but like a filmed version of it. Like they do with Cats, but maybe not yeah. not like what they did with Cats, because that was not a success. Did you see it?
No, but I was just, you know, puppets reminded me. Actually, last night I watched your entire third season, the puppet musical.
Okay.
Because it's I'll link it. It's accessible. And boy, right on. It was just so charming and beautiful.
the third one.
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
It's okay. On that the YouTube of the festival in Hamburg.
Did you see the second one?
I only saw parts of it, but the third one, I just sat and watched the whole thing through.
Cool. See, again, for me, it's hard to watch. Also, that was like maybe the second run. Like we were just getting our feet, and like that show really started coming together. So to watch it and like see every mistake and every sort of slow entrance and is painful. But But yeah, I'm glad that the film that Kiran Ahluwalia, she's pretty cool, right?
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing, like my kids are grown up now, but we used to love going to children's theater. It's such a specialized genre. And I remember talking to one of the actors and they said, my whole career has been doing this. Mm-hmm. And that's what amazes me about you. Cause you know, you're this hip hop guy, you do all this stuff. And then what, this amazing musical theater for kids, and it works on all the levels for all the adults.
Well, I mean, it's weird cause I don't really think about doing it for kids. Mm-hmm. But then surprise, surprise, funny, fuzzy creatures like singing songs, like kids love it. So that's awesome. But I think that is a trick for people that create for kids that they don't necessarily think down or yeah. like I don't, when I was writing it, I wasn't thinking, well, this song is okay, but if I could make it easier to understand or something. No, like you just try to write good songs. You try to write mm-hmm. catchy melodies and you try to write a story that is clear. I mean, obviously not every clear story is going to be appropriate for kids. And like, I'm sitting right now in my childhood bedroom and I'm surrounded by childhood stuff. And I think I had a pretty good childhood where the things that I loved as a child, like I still love them. Like I can sort of in a weird way, remember the vibe of being a kid. Mm-hmm. And that probably comes out in the sort of playfulness of the shows that I do.
So you had one grandfather who was a magician who, some magic.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you do magic too.
Uh-huh. I mean, yeah, it's one of my hobbies. When you see people that it's their whole lives, then I think I'm not really a magician, but it's a hobby and an interest. I mean, I was practicing yesterday. Mm-hmm. I have my set right over there. I was practicing mm-hmm. the cups and balls. Here, look, I could show you an incredible trick with this. Watch.
You're really good. Okay, some people are listening to the podcast and they're like, what did he just do?
He made a yellow thing disappear.
Yeah.
So yeah, magic. These are all hobbies and things I started as a kid and I just kept hacking away at and maybe got better at for sure at a certain point. I hope, I like to think.
How about your musical education? Like
you Not took
piano
much.
Lessons?
I took piano lessons. That was it. I took piano lessons in Ottawa from a piano teacher named Gabor Finta. You ever hear of him?
Yeah.
Okay, so Gabor Finta taught like, what was that method of like where kids listen and like they don't learn the names of the notes and they just learn to sing things and stuff?
You mean
Kodai.
Oh, Kodai.
Kodai. So he was from the Kodai school. I don't really know what of the method that I learned was very Kodai-ish. I always had a really good ear, so I was a terrible reader. I just never learned how to read. Because I could just pick it up by ear. Mm-hmm. And so to this day, I'm a terrible reader. I've gotten way better, but it's a struggle. I feel almost dyslexic when it comes to music reading. Like, it's just like, I just can't, it just like takes forever to get through a bar. So that was, I mean, as a kid taking piano lessons, forced, bribed to take it, but I had a good ear and I was musical. So I would enter competitions. I would win Kiwanis things here and there. And eventually I got to take like jazz piano lessons. And I studied with this guy, Peter Brown in town, who's still actively playing around town. And that was for me cooler because I could improvise and it was sort of just, it wasn't just always classical music, which I didn't really speak to me necessarily. And that was it for musical education. I went to McGill to study like literature and philosophy and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad I did. At the time, I didn't want to study something that I loved and just did for fun. I never thought I was going to be a musician. I was making beats at the time. And so like, that's what I would do for fun. I would get home from school and I would make beats. and then So education wise, now I wish I had studied composition and harmony, And so like, here I am looking at like this Barry Harris, who just passed away a couple months ago, this 91-year-old jazz educator. And he's sort of talking about harmony and stuff. And I'm trying to understand that. And like, I guess I just teach myself. That's how I learned how to arrange. I just sort of started doing it and popping notes into Sibelius and then and seeing how things move around. But now I do wish that I had studied. I wish it was just deeply ingrained in me so that I could just sort of spew it out. But yeah.
Yeah, if you'd spent the time back then doing that, you wouldn't have had time for all this other stuff. That's the trouble, right? That's only...
Yeah, you're right. And you never know what you're going to get. Like, you don't know why you're on a path or why you're not on another path. And like, studying literature and philosophy is like, I don't regret that. That just is good for a brain to do. And it does. And it helps. If you just study music, you can become sort of stuck in the technical, like, endless war that it is to master an instrument or to master the theory of it, which is endless, and it's going to drive you crazy. And then you sort of forget that there's a world that you should be trying to sort of engage the music with, maybe, or something, or there's stories to tell that you can use music. But so it's good to open your mind and study just how to think.
Yeah. I used to think, you know, when I got my career established as a violinist, I would magically have all this time to learn other instruments. This was my fantasy.
Okay.
So not true, right? Just right. Still learning to play the violin every day. It's just I have to do, you know?
Right.
So let's talk about a lot of really legendary people you've worked with, like Fred Wesley, right?
Yes. Yeah. Fred Wesley. He is, I mean, that's a good one to start with because he is really my hero. And he is, I mean, he created my favorite music of all time, which is the funk of James Brown in the 1970s. He was the guy writing the horn lines and being the band leader for those sessions of the JBs, the James Brown band, in the 1970s, the early 70s. So literally my favorite music. I mean, you can put on Pass the Peas by James Brown and it's like, there's nothing better. Like it never got better. Sure. I love Brahms. I love Kurt Weill. I love Charlie Parker. I love Brazilian music. I love, you know, everything. But for some reason, and maybe it's just because it was what I loved when I was 15, which winds up being the music that you sort of think is the most important, and it kind of gets ingrained in your DNA. So Fred Wesley is a trombone player, and it's a long story, but basically I found out he was being active and still on tour. Basically the drummer in this band, I was playing with David Krakauer, who is this virtuoso clarinetist, who has a classical career, but is like well known for his klezmer, his clarinet klezmer. He's also a teacher. He teaches at basically every famous music school in New York City. He's got a position at whatever, you name it, he's teaching. An incredible player. Like he really is just an amazing player. So already that's cool to be working with him. And I was in his band and helping him sort of produce his records and make his sort of brand of funky modern klezmer music. And then we were hanging out one night and the drummer in the band said, yeah, my friend plays with Fred Wesley. He's in Fred Wesley's band. I was like, Fred Wesley is still on tour? Oh my God. Like that's incredible. And it just sort of got me thinking like, what if we got Fred Wesley to deal with klezmer and Jewish music and particularly this project with David Krakauer, what if we got him together? So I suggested it and like Krakauer like was all over it. And he was like, oh my God, this would be amazing. And through this drummer guy and the friend and then the manager and the this and that, and we had the same publisher in Europe, we got in touch with Fred Wesley and basically cold called him, hey, would you be interested in a project looking at this Eastern European Jewish dance music from the 19th century? Like how insane is that? I bet 99% of professional legendary musicians would not open that email, would not answer, certainly, but just they wouldn't cry. Like, why would they? Fred Wesley is happily on tour. He's a world famous legend of his style. He does not need to be doing weird things. But Fred Wesley is such a cool guy, and he's so into music and into collaboration that he wrote back and said, huh, that sounds kind of interesting. Send me something to listen to. So we sent him like recordings from the 1920s of these bands, which actually do have a lot of brass and are mm-hmm. and are danceable and catchy and funky and in virtuoso playing and beautiful melodies. And as a great musician who has his ears open and just is like looking for opportunities to explore, which is so rare. And he's also just the quintessential collaborator. Like he's collaborated with just, I mean, he played with Ray Charles and Count Basie and Ike and Tina Turner and Michael Jackson and like whatever. I mean, he's played with great people. And as a collaborator, like he brings himself and his voice to these projects, but he's able to help those projects be better, like without being like coming and just being the star, you know, like mm-hmm. he's just got this humble collaboration vibe. And so he said, wow, these are beautiful songs. This is cool. Let's meet. And so we met and we jammed. Like I had my machine. He's also, I mean, as the guy who invented funk, which then became disco, which then became hip hop, basically. I mean, he's basically the godfather of hip hop. He's been sampled to death. All that James Brown music has been sampled all over the place. He even rapped, I mean, on this record from 1972, there's a song called Brother Got the Rap or something. And James Brown says, Fred, like rap. He says rap. And it's 1972. Mm-hmm. And Fred Wesley says, I don't want nobody telling me what to do. And he talks mm-hmm. in rhyme over top of a beat. Well, I mean, that's rap, isn't it? Mm-hmm. So in a way, he was the inventor of this whole genre that has gone on to become a worldwide, total global phenomenon of every culture of art, mm-hmm. music, dance, and like music and song and poetry. So Fred Wesley, he's the godfather. And when we met, he was like, I don't really like rap. I don't like hip hop. Like, I don't get it. And I had my machine with me, which is which samples and you make loops and you make beats. And by the end of our, like the jam, he was like, that's pretty cool. Actually, he was seeing the potential for the machine in music, that it didn't necessarily take his job away, which I think a lot of real musicians were afraid that hip hop would do, and it did for sure. But it was pretty cool for me to sort of bring Fred Wesley back to hip hop, or like to show him that there was like the viability of this music that mm-hmm. actually he was sort of the inventor of. So Fred Wesley, what an honor to work with him. And then from then we created that band called Abraham Incorporated, which has a full brass section and Fred Wesley and David Krakauer. And that is awesome. We've had, of course, three tours now canceled since the beginning of this pandemic, trying to, because we actually made a new record 2 years ago or three, I guess now it's 5 years ago because it was 2 years before the end of the world. And then like I just work with him now, like we're friends. I text him and he says, what's up? And for my musicals, I get him to write the overtures.
Yeah. I was going to mention that. Fantastic.
Which is insane. to get the guy who wrote for Parliament Funkadelic. I send him the melodies for like the themes, and then he like writes an overture. And he even did it for the Odessa Stories musical. He wrote the overture. So Fred Wesley wrote for cymbalom and accordion and clarinet. And it's those kind of connections and weird meetings that like absolutely blow my mind and make life worth living.
Yeah, that thing about the cold call. So I bet you've done a few more of those in your career.
Yeah, I mean, often cold calls don't really get you anywhere, to be honest. It usually helps to have some sort of in. I mean, the Fred Wesley call was cold, but it was also through the connection of the drummer and the publisher. Mm-hmm. And so like someone gave him the phone. If I were to call Tom Waits and say, hey, Tom, do you want to do a song with me? I'm not getting through. Like, you know what I'm saying? Also, it might've been a different time, a bit earlier. Mm-hmm. Now with the interconnection and the internet where everybody's on everybody's ass all the time, it's harder to make a connection that cuts through to somebody.
Yeah.
If you're on Twitter and you're famous, well, you're getting 1,000 emails a day from different people who want to do something. So this was kind of more a pre-digital meeting of just like, it was probably through a letter in the mail or something. Mm-hmm. So things had to have a way of connecting better like that. And I can't think of other people. I guess Kiran Ahluwalia, no offense to Kiran Ahluwalia, she's not quite on the same level as Fred Wesley, but to me, she was a cool genius musician artist that I thought, wouldn't that be interesting to get her? She sings, as you know from last night, she's like this Indian classical singer from Canada, but she lives in New York City. And that was kind of a cold call. Like she's Canadian, so there was a bit of a connection there. And actually I know her accordionist, so there was a bit of a connection there. But it was basically, I went to her concert in Montreal and I said, and after the concert, I approached her and said, hey, Kiran, I'm thinking of this musical and I think you'd be cool. I'm having a human. Every season has a human in it. It's a bunch of puppets with one human. And Fred Wesley was in one, by the way. You should watch it too. I think it's also online. Fred Wesley with the puppets. Again, what an incredible testament to his openness and bravery. For him to say, okay, I mean, he's 77 years old. Like, do you want to be in a musical with puppets where you're on stage acting and singing with puppets? Like, no, like I don't, but for some reason he said, yeah, man, that sounds cool. I'll do it. So that was amazing. So Kiran Ahluwalia, I just said, hey, would you do that? I guess it's easier when you have a track record. And now I have a bit of a track record and I have people that I've worked with. So I can send people. So is there something I can hear? Okay, there is. So that helps. But I still feel like a novice and it's imposter syndrome, right? Like that is real. like I sit here every day feeling like an imposter, like 100%. Sure, I get better at things. I know I'm good at stuff, but I'll guess I'll never be good enough for myself to be. I mean, I'm good at stuff, but I'll never be Charlie Parker. I'll never be Kurt Vile. I'll be me and I'll try to be the best me that can be. And part of feeling that imposter syndrome, I think, is motivating to keep working and to keep trying to get better so that maybe one day you won't feel like an imposter.
I was just thinking, so that the NFB movie about you, the so-called movie, I think it's been about 14 years now.
Wow.
You said almost exactly what you just said now. So I was going to ask you about that, but you just went there.
Yeah, and 14 years later, I swear to God, I'm not just saying that to seem like I swear to God, I sit here frustratedly hacking away, feeling like an idiot all day. Sure, I know when I get somewhere, and I know when I like things that I do, and I can listen to things. I'm not one of those people that just like can't ever see or hear what they've done again. When I make something that I've worked hard at to make good, and then it is good, then I'm happy. Like there's a song the song I never got to sing on, I think I might have even done it. No, I didn't do it in Ottawa, but it's from the second musical, the second season, and it's with Fred Wesley. And I think it's my best song. Like, and so to recognize that for myself is good. Like, I can hear, it's called the song I never got to sing.
Oh, that's what it's called.
Okay. That's what it's called. Yeah. Okay. And it's just, it brings together all my experience and the lyrics and the melody, and it's a bit of the Jewish music, and it's working with Fred Wesley and the arrangement and the recording and the story, and it's all that, and it's finally got to 1-2 minutes of something mm-hmm. that I can go, ah, okay, if I die now, at least there's that one song that people can hear that I like. I don't cringe when I hear mm-hmm. it.
Your song, I'm trying to remember. Oh, I can't think of it now. It's that beautiful song about being who you are with kids, and there's like the amazing head dresses, and they're what's the name of that song?
Okay, Work With What You Got.
Yeah, that's the one.
Okay.
Did you design those costumes?
No. Nope, that was folks out in Vancouver of all places. Mm-hmm. And a very weird video, but okay, cool. When I make a video, often, I haven't in a long time, unfortunately, like just because the industry has changed. Like I used to be able to make a video. I'd make a record and then the label would be like, okay, and now make a video. That doesn't happen anymore. Like I've got to raise all the money myself, and I've got to, you got to make the record yourself and pay for all that too. Like it's just so you make crappy videos yourself or, I don't know. Anyway, so that, but usually when I was making videos, for me, it was fun to work with someone who had ideas mm-hmm. that I could just like, they would be free to do their thing. I'd made the song. Now you be creative. You bring your genius. And so like my most sort of viral famous thing I ever did was the head coming open video. Yeah. And it was sort of an idea that we had together, the director, but mostly it was that amazing genius director that heard the song and was inspired. Go to it. I didn't want to be like micromanaging every choice of with that mm-hmm. with those kind of collaborations. And that's kind of the same with all my collaborations. Like I'm a control freak and I like to see things through, but once I'm working with someone who is a genius and like that's why I'm working with them, I'm gonna let them be a genius mm-hmm. to enrich everything.
Would you speak a little bit about your Yiddish culture cruise that you did many years ago? Such an Ooh. Amazing story.
Sure. So basically, how does that one start? I mean, like I'd started going to being involved in the Yiddish revival movement. For lack of a better term, that's what it is. Like in the late 70s, these hippies started getting into these archives and discovering this culture that had either died out with the Holocaust and been killed off, or had been assimilated in North America. People stopped speaking Yiddish. Okay, people like Henry Sapoznik and Zev Feldman started discovering this old material and talking about it, discovering old musicians even that were still around. Hot tip, Dave Terrace, the greatest klezmer clarinetist of all time. There's an amazing video of him doing a whole concert that was presented in 1979. By these people. They were like, they'd found him, he was still alive, and they put on this concert. You can see it on YouTube. It's awesome. I mean, he's super old, but he still is just mind-blowing. So they started to reissue things, and then they started to have these camps and these like retreats for Yiddish culture. And the first big one was really Klez Camp in New York in the Catskills. And so they started to invite some of the old masters that were still alive, and they started to try to sing the songs again. And then these sort of bands popped up, like the Klezmorim in California or the Capella in New York. And they started to play the songs again. They started to learn the style or try to sing the Yiddish songs. Of course, there were still people that knew this stuff, like your parents. And like the people in the Montreal Yiddish Theater, like there was still people that spoke Yiddish and sang Yiddish songs. So the idea of revival is problematic because, sorry, it wasn't dead. And also, I mean, like you were saying, the Hasidim speak Yiddish. So like the language itself is spoken by millions of people. So anyway, but in the mainstream Jewish culture, Yiddish was not present. So they started to have these festivals. And then it became sort of an international movement. And then there was new bands that were taking the music even further, the Klezmatics. They were adding rock and roll and jazz to the mix. And they were, you know, and then I came around in the 2000s, and I was adding hip hop. And like, and so the music was evolving and changing with the times. And these festivals were sort of at the heart of that movement. And out of those festivals came all these bands and all this activity, and records were being made. And there was sort of a golden age in the late 90s of the revival with people like the Klezmatics. And then they like met with, what's his name?
Itzhak Perlman.
Itzhak Perlman, who I also played with. And we could talk about that too, if you want. And so they had a, like kind of a real moment there where they were doing huge concerts with Itzhak Perlman and doing klezmer. And that's great. Well, meanwhile, I was starting to be invited to these festivals because I was doing something kind of new with this mix of hip hop. So I was invited to London Klezfest, and I was invited to Paris Klezfest, and I was invited to Los Angeles Klezfest. And then I was invited to St. Petersburg Klezfest, which was particularly interesting because it was, to me anyway, it was interesting because it was there. It was where the culture came from, sort of. I mean, that was part of the story. And at that festival were a lot of people from Eastern Europe. So people from former Soviet places, people from Moldova and Romania, which is where my people were from, that were still there. They were still living there and still singing Yiddish songs. And so I started to meet people there, and I thought, wouldn't it be awesome to have a festival back in the source? So St. Petersburg isn't exactly the source. It's I mean, sure, it's nearby, but like it's not. I was thinking more like Romania, Ukraine, and at least like actually somewhere where my grandfather was from, which was near Odessa in the Ukraine. So just on a whim, I started talking to people. I was like, wouldn't it be awesome to have a festival in Odessa or a festival in Chisinev in Moldova or something? People were like, yeah, that'd be cool. And then I don't know why, I guess we were on a boat. At some point I went back to Odessa with my parents. I don't know how that started, but just we thought it would be cool to visit where, you know, the grandparents were from. And so I was on tour, and I said, okay, after my tour, I'll meet you in Odessa. And so we did that. And maybe then we were on a boat, and I thought, imagine like a cruise, like a klezmer Yiddish festival on a boat back in the source. So it was just a stupid idea. I told my parents, and for some reason, like now thinking back, I don't know how on earth this actually happened, but my parents got interested and they got involved in, and they said, this is a cool idea. Why don't, let's do it. Like, we'll organize it. Like thinking back, it blows my mind. So we started to really put a plan together and hire a boat. My parents are both from Winnipeg, which is where the people that didn't go to Montreal went when they came to Canada from Eastern Europe. So my parents are both from Winnipeg, where there's a big population of what are they? This religion of kind of Christians.
The Mennonites?
The Mennonites. There's a huge Mennonite community also from Ukraine. And so we started looking into it, and we found that they had Mennonite culture cruises where people would go back to the Ukraine and visit their roots. Well, we got in touch with them and we sort of coordinated with them. And actually my parents went on a Mennonite cruise to get the vibe. And it was a boat that went along the Dnieper River from Kiev to Odessa. And we thought, okay, cool, like perfect. We'll sort of like, we'll plop our klezmer cruise onto the shape that they've already created. And so I hired like all the best klezmer people that I knew from the scene, David Krakauer and Michael Alpert, this amazing trumpet player from Philly, Susan Hoffman Watts, and her mother, Elaine Hoffman Watts. Unfortunately, in the end, they couldn't come. But Ilana Kravitz from London plays violin, and who else? Vanya Zhuk, for this amazing guitarist from Russia, someone from Paris, someone from London, someone from here and there. Sort of an international crew. I hired this older French lady who's an expert in Jewish dance. I hired I just kind of invited, and they could come for free. Eugene Orenstein from Montreal, who's like this amazing, the head of the Jewish studies department at McGill, a Yiddish language professor. This guy David Katz came, who is like a super famous Yiddishist who's based in Lithuania. And so all those people were like the staff. But then 200 people signed up to come. So we have this boat, this cruise ship, leaving from Kiev and going down the Dnieper River, with concerts every night. This guy got on the boat halfway through, who lived in Dniepropetrovsk in Zaporozhye, and his name was Arkady Gendler. And he was actually a guy I'd met in St. Petersburg. And maybe he was one of the reasons I'd thought of the whole idea. But he was still based in this town where my grandfather was from. And he sort of became the heart and soul and spirit of the cruise. And we would do concerts. We'd stay up every night in the bar, drinking vodka and playing music and singing Yiddish songs. And then we'd get to a town and we'd do a concert in the town. We'd go to these little towns or even big towns, Kiev and Odessa, and we'd like put on a concert for the public with local musicians. And yeah, that was sort of how the whole so-called movie started, because I pitched this idea to my old professor, Gary Beitel. He was my professor at McGill. I said, you should come and make a movie about this boat cruise. And he did. But then that became a movie more about me, which is too bad, because he's got tons of footage of just the boat cruise. And that was sort of what I thought the movie was about. And then it turned out to be a movie about me, which is cool, but also a pain in the ass. and also we didn't get to see enough about the cruise. Mm-hmm. I'd love to revisit that footage one day, and maybe like that could be expanded into a whole situation. Yeah.
That's a good idea.
Okay. I'll call Gary later.
And actually, yeah, I was wondering if you're still friends with him after all that.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
In the movie, which is great, you got a chance to do some of your filmmaking. There's like these little episodes that are really cool.
I'd love to. Yeah, that was super fun.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I think in your interview with your friend Daniel Mate recently, like online too, you had talked about...
You really digging deep here.
Oh, I do research.
Okay.
Yeah, you'd mentioned during the pandemic that you were like doing just portraits of friends was one of your ways of coping.
Yeah. Yeah. And that came out of nowhere. I mean, I never drew before. I mean, I drew cartoons as a kid. Never really seriously. I mean, I never had time to do things. Mm-hmm. So since I've been sitting here, I've started drawing. Let me see if I have some kicking around here. Yeah, just a second.
Sure.
I'm attached. Yeah, I mean, I was going insane, and I'm still going insane. Yeah. But in a weird way, it's like a new kind of insane. I have sort of found a Zen insanity, but no, I was going insane. Just like, what do you do? Like, so we've had this lovely talk where you hear about all these cool things that I do, right? And I'm doing theater, and I'm meeting cool people, and I'm doing concerts, and that was fun. That was great. And that was my life. I was a busy, productive artist traveling the world, doing what I like, exploring, trying new projects, chasing my dreams, as they say. It ended. It's over. It's like, it ain't happening right now. It's really not. And it's And the first 2 months, you're like, okay, this sucks, but like, okay, it'll, then the next 2 months, then the next 2 months. And now we're entering the third year of this thing. Luckily, in the fall, I managed to sort of sneak out and do some concerts. That concert in Ottawa was like at the perfect little window of opportunity where things actually happened. And I went to Germany a couple times actually over the summer and fall, and I did concerts, and surprise, surprise, they were really fun. And like, wow, I like doing that. So that's great. But so I went insane and I started to draw. And I, like, I'd never really drawn before. Like, I'd never drawn seriously before.
Wow.
I still don't really draw seriously, but I started to draw just like.
Okay. So some people are listening to the podcast. So these are fine pencil drawings, or are they ink as well?
This is the pencil kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And look, I mean, each page is like, that represents a night of trying to not go insane. So I would sit there and draw for like 6 hours. I would spend on these drawings.
That's really amazing, Josh. So these are from memory or from photos?
They're from photographs. Mm-hmm. And yeah, and I filled up about four, like, these are, wait, that one's not full yet. Oh, that's a new one. I just bought a fresh one. Like,
these, are you going to sell these?
I don't know what I'm going to do. So like all my other passions, yeah, these are, it sort of starts off as a hobby and then maybe it'll lead to something. I don't know. I think,
yeah, you're really good.
Ceci n'est pas un NFT.
I didn't understand that.
And you know, NFTs, these non-fungible tokens. Oh, you haven't been following the news. Then I started getting it. Then I started drawing some calligraphy. Yeah. Okay.
Beautiful.
Fine. Calligraphy. Anyway, trying to not go insane. Then I did a series of philosophers with food. Mm-hmm. Okay. So here's Nietzsche with ceviche, Hume with a shroom. Hegel with a bagel. Okay. Oh, and then doodling. I mean, just constant, yeah, sort of these, wow, endless doodles. Ay, ay, ay. So, whew, trying to not go insane. And it works. When I get inspired to dig into something like that, that's the best thing. Like when I can just lose myself in a project and forget, mm-hmm, that's awesome. But that doesn't always happen. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's some days where you don't want to do any, you aren't inspired to doodle or to do a portrait. Cause also it's hard. Like, it's like, ugh, I know I'm going to be here for 4 hours doing this if I want it to be finished and good. So it's like, I don't want to do that today. And then you're depressed for another reason, cause you haven't done anything. Mm-hmm. And so, you know how it is.
Yeah, I was reading a book about the flow state and how to be in it more. And there's all these many, many feel-good chemicals that are released when we're in flow state. Uh-huh. So there's a real chemistry to it, which is interesting.
Big time. And you can't force it. It's magic. It's like, I don't know, maybe your books have methods about how to get into it. But I have not found a fail-safe way to just, okay, you're going to get in the flow state. No way. You got to just be touched by the muse somehow.
Well, I think one thing I read about, which made sense to me as a performer, is there's definitely a continuum. It's not like a switch. It's not like you're in it or you're out of it. There's definitely sometimes it's like, I'd say continuum. Mm-hmm. But you did mention Yitzhak Perlman, and mm-hmm, I have not heard that story, although his name was floated about your website maybe. So.
Okay. It's not the most exciting story, I must say, of collaboration, just because, I mean, he's kind of on a whole other level, maybe in his own mind too, as an artist and as a performer. So, you know, there's that project of him playing Jewish music. Mm. And 1 year, it wasn't that long ago, Lauren Sklamberg, who is an amazing Yiddish singer and accordionist. He's the lead singer for the Klezmatics. He is normally in that project. He couldn't do it. So Hank Osnetsky, who is another legendary name in the Yiddish music world, who is the musical director of that project, he called me and said, can you come and do, I think it was 4 concerts, like in the States, come on tour and play with Itzhak Perlman and the band. Wow. Actually, I had another gig that I had to cancel that I hadn't quite confirmed yet in Germany. And I got in a lot of trouble because I said, yo, I have to do this. I've got to go play with Itzhak Perlman. And I did. I learned the repertoire and went and did it. But he was kind of in his own little world. I mean, he kind of showed up 5 minutes before the gig and rolled on stage and killed it and then rolled off stage. And that was it. Yes, we hung out. We ate together several times. Just playing with him was thrilling. He is clearly an insanely amazing musician. Maybe not as much now as he was in his heyday, but boy, oh boy, can he play the fiddle. He's not a master of Jewish violin. That's a different story. And like, I think part of, to me, a bit of a lost opportunity is that because he's so famous and like such a legend, that maybe he wasn't quite open to really digging in and learning about actually playing like quote unquote traditional legitimate klezmer style Yiddish violin. Mm-hmm. But he's just such an incredible musician, like that wasn't the gig, you know. But my most favorite memory of that whole tour was being backstage one day before the show, and I was with Frank London, who's another legend in the scene. He's the trumpet player, and we were like just jamming and we were just sort of hanging out playing tunes when Itzhak Perlman came over and started jamming with us. And it was just organic and just like normal musician behavior. But that to me is the special memory that I'll take away from that experience.
Sure. And you worked with Theodore Bikel?
Mm-hmm.
How do you say his name?
I think it's Bikel. Yeah.
Yeah.
People say Bikel. Yeah. Oi. And that, I mean, actually right this minute, I'm trying to learn some lyrics mm-hmm. for a Bikel song. And if you can describe to your listeners, this is like chicken scratch.
Yeah.
like trying to memorize lyrics. So I'm trying to learn a Bikel song. I got to work with Theodore Bikel. And now that he's gone, I literally can't believe it. Mm-hmm. The more I learn about him, the more I see what he did, the more I watch on YouTube, like because I still kind of look into him now, like, and maybe more than I did when he was alive and I knew him and I worked with him. Mm-hmm. Was that guy amazing? Like, okay, he was in the African Queen with Humphrey Bogart. He was in the original cast of The Sound of Music. He was the lead in the original cast on Broadway of The Sound of Music. He was in a movie with Frank Zappa. He was on Dynasty and The Love Boat. He played Worf's father on Star Trek: The Next Generation. He was in a movie with Sidney Poitier. Like, you know, like just like lately when Sidney Poitier passed away, I was like, huh, I'm gonna look up Sidney Poitier in Theo's autobiography, and sure enough, he's got a whole entry about Sidney Poitier. I mean, he was friends with Odetta and friends with Frank Sinatra and Bob Dylan and like Steven Spielberg and Mel Brooks and just like literally Hollywood legend. And I worked with him. Mm-hmm. Now I cannot believe it. I kick myself for not asking him more questions and trying to hang out with him more or something. I mean, I don't know what I should have done. But luckily I worked with him. He was in Montreal actually when his wife passed away. She was an incredible musician. Tamara Brooks was this amazing pianist and conductor, like a for real conductor of orchestras. And she taught conducting at NEC and like, just like an amazing, like, always the most heavy musician in the room whenever you were with her. And she was married to Theo, and she had this amazing, just like childlike love of him and his genius. And I mean, he was definitely a theatrical genius and like an acting genius. Like, I mean, he studied with Sir Laurence Olivier and like, I mean, just the whole his history is unbelievable. And just getting parts in like these huge productions and just in Hollywood movies. But also musically, I'm realizing more and more what a genius he was. I kind of took it for granted. He was this guy with a guitar and he would sing folk songs. Oh my God. You go back and listen to Theodore Bekel recordings. They're just astounding. And she would look at him with just this like glee of like, and so to see this heavy classical musician that was with this guy with a guitar, and she would look over at the piano just like in awe of him. I don't think I got it until I'm just starting to get it now of what an insane genius he was. So when she passed away, she was much younger than him, but she died before he did, which was super tragic and super sad for me personally, because she was kind of like an in to him. Like we got along for some reason. She really accepted me. And so whenever I needed to do something with Theo, I would shoot her an email. I'd say, hey, Tamara, could we do this project? And she'd say, yeah, sure, I'll talk to Theo about it. Mm-hmm. She was kind of his manager too. But for her to accept me and see what I was doing was cool, was like amazing and so important for a young musician to get that kind of support. When I went to LA once to play a show with my like crazy hip hop, like funky Jewish band, they were there. They showed up in the audience. There's Theodore Bekel in the audience. Okay. I invited him on stage. He came and sang a song, which became Mein Städte Labels, which we eventually like put on record. But just that kind of support is just invaluable. Like an older established musicians, sure, they'll come and support something but to really make an effort to support people is like just it's amazing. So she passed away, and he had a show scheduled in Montreal, like of a run of a theater piece that he was doing of Sholem Aleichem stories and songs. And I got a call from Theo saying, hey, Tamara has died, like, but I have this show. Will you be the accompanist? Because she was his accompanist. And so, I mean, I didn't want to do it because I was scared. Like, I those were very big shoes to fill. Mm-hmm. But I also wanted to do it because, like, what an honor and what a fascinating gig it would be to do that. So I accepted. It was a super short turnaround too. Like, just like, it's in a month. Like, we got a rehearsal start in a month. So I started learning a repertoire and boy, I mean, again, life is so weird. Like, I can't imagine. We spent 3 weeks rehearsing it, you know? I can't remember that. I don't remember that, but I guess that was cool. But I literally cannot remember. Then we did the show for 2 or 3 weeks. And that is just something I'll remember as like a feeling. Like, I don't remember the specifics of it, mm-hmm. but just to remember going to the theater to be backstage, hanging out with Theodore Bekel, putting on, you know, him getting made up in the makeup chair. And then just doing a show every day, like for 2 or 3 weeks, that's awesome. And that's like an experience that happens not as much as it should anymore. Just that sort of, and that's what he had so much of. He's mm-hmm. so lucky to have lived in a culture of like theater and like putting on a show and rehearsals and backstage. And so I got a taste of that. And I got a taste of that with the master. And like, we hung out. Like during the run, he came over to my apartment 2 or 3 times. I have a shitty apartment. Like it's a hellhole, crappy apartment. Like, it's not pretty. And so to have this like 85-year-old like theater legend hanging out like in this shitty basement apartment just because he's cool like that, listening to old records and like looking through old books together. Unbelievable. Luckily, I take a lot of pictures, and so those become my memories, and so I can remember that. Like I have that fixed in my mind. Or just going out to eat with him, like picking him up at his hotel and going out to eat, and he was voluble with stories and just and songs and melodies and anecdotes and wow, and it's sad. The problem with having 90-year-old friends is that they do die. They have a tendency to die, and so he's gone. And I have so now that I'm grown up, and I have so many more questions I'd love to ask him.
Yeah, I mean, you've played many famous halls. I've seen that feeling that you described, you know, the memory of the feeling. Do you feel that about having been at the Apollo or like different, you know, Carnegie Hall, different of your?
Yeah, like I mean, it's a feeling, and memory is weird, isn't it? I think, in fact, it's sort of what the fourth season is going to be about. Is will be about time and how time has a way of. Just how it has its way with you, and how you can be stuck in time, but it's endless, but it's finite, and it's and these memories, it's trippy. And thank goodness, on the one hand, I'm grateful for the photographs, but on the other hand, they're a curse because it sort of becomes all you remember of a certain thing. But it's better than not remembering at all. So. Yeah, I'm glad I took a lot of pictures along the way.
Well, I want to thank you for your time today. It was just fascinating talking to you.
My pleasure. I mean, I'm glad to meet you, and I hope we can hang out in real life someday. Yeah. And I want to hear about your journey. I mean, this interview it's cool for me to blab about my story and stuff, but like, actually, I like to just hang out and have a nice conversation with you someday.
Season 1 of this podcast had 20 episodes, and season 2 continues with a really interesting mix of musicians talking about their lives and careers with perspectives on overcoming challenges, finding inspiration and connection through a life so enriched with music. Please follow this podcast wherever you listen to podcasts to be informed about each new episode.